I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Chasing Justice. I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro, and this is a power-packed day we got today. Before I get going, I do want to tell you, you know, recently I've been honored by the America Out Loud platform and the showrunner, the guy that makes it all happen, the great Malcolm Out Loud, has asked me to be the fill-in host for the Sunday, Viewpoint This Sunday show, which I've done last week. I did this past week, and I'll be doing it again in the future, in the very near future. I want to tell you, these are really amazing shows. The amount of time and energy that the team puts into this show. If you haven't listened to Viewpoint This Sunday yet, whether I'm the host or Malcolm's back, you really want to spend some time there. 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday mornings. Fantastic show. It's really, really great. And I really enjoyed being a part of it and working with all the great people there. You know, people you've heard of here on America Out Loud. Ava Armstrong, Jim McKay, Dennis Santiago, Ilana Friedman. Really, really awesome people. And the reason I'm mentioning that here on Chasing Justice is because our topics recently we talked about was the obvious, very dangerous events that are taking place in Iran, in Iraq, Iran, that part of the world that involve now the United States and you, the American public. So we've seen very recently there was a well-known terrorist, a well-known bad guy, a negative player on the scene out there, the Iranian general Soleimani. Or Soleimani. There's different ways to pronounce it. I don't mean to pronounce it incorrectly. Soleimani, I think that could be it also. Well, recently, he was in Iraq, and he was fomenting some kind of trouble, probably some attacks on the embassy. Our American embassy was attacked over in Iraq. And if it wasn't for the speed of the response by President Trump, we probably would have had another travesty like Benghazi. The difference between Benghazi and here was because our president received a call for help, and he sent immediately military reinforcements to the embassy. And I got to tell you, if you get a chance to go see the video of the arrival of the United States military personnel, they landed on the roof of the embassy, and you see these three vehicles land on the roof, and you see our American military personnel piling out of these vehicles and running into the embassy. I can only imagine how comforting that must have been to the people in that embassy to see the United States Marines showing up. You know, it's reminiscent for an incident that took place many years ago when another great American president, Ronald Reagan, sent troops down to Grenada when the island was being taken over by communists at the time, and they attacked the American medical school on the island, and they were under attack, and there was American medical students there, and there was a movie that they made about the American military response there, and the best scene ever had to be these American medical students were all huddled into a room, and there's gunfire going on outside, and they know they're coming for them because they know they're Americans. And all of a sudden, the door bursts open, and everyone is scared to death, and they think this is it, this is the moment they're going to die. And through the door come United States Marines, really powerful. They come through, you see the flag come through, United States Marines, and everyone cheered, and you know, you felt great watching the movie, you felt great. You can only imagine that that's exactly how it felt in Iraq at the American embassy when those vehicles landed on the roof and those Marines got out of those vehicles. You know, our military is really, really, truly amazing. But let's take a look at that situation. So if you get a chance to go to the podcasts, the Viewpoint This Sunday for the most recent show, outrageous. It was really, really good. Dennis Santiago and Ilana Friedman are amazing experts, subject matter experts in this area. And we really unpacked the history, you know, because it's like I look at it as a three-legged stool. You have to understand the past and what kind of happened in Iran and the interaction with America to understand what's going on now, and then you have to be able to see the future. So that three-legged stool is all part of what we need to understand to get a real picture of the potentiality of what's going on here, the danger we could possibly be in, the way the world could change, the potential for war that is looming out there. Because I know a lot of people are very concerned that this is the precursor to a bigger hot war in the region. I don't know that it is. I think there's going to be some things that go on, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But as we go through this opening together here, I just want to tell you, if you get a chance to listen to that show, you really would enjoy yourself. And I also spent time with Jim McKay, who's another one of the great commentators here on America Out Loud. That is an excellent show for my audience to go check out if you haven't gone yet. So, you know, I'll be there again another week, 10 a.m. on Sundays at the Viewpoint this Sunday. All right, so here on Chasing Justice, we had planned to have the neighborhood guys in. You know, I'm missing them fellas. Jim is still on vacation. Jack, of course, Jack's always racing somewhere, rock and roll race car Jack. Bill, the man of faith, Dallas, was with us not too long ago. But all these guys promise that they'll be here shortly. Another episode that I'm working on now, which I think will be really great for my law enforcement compatriots, and really for all of yous that really want to get a great insight into law enforcement. I am writing a law enforcement kind of, it's not really a memoir. What it really is, it's a collection of stories, really, from my career and the career of other officers that I worked with, and we call it Tales from the Road. And it's vignettes. Some of them are short, some of them are funny, some of them, you know, are longer investigations that we worked on. But all of them have all the elements of what makes law enforcement interesting and exciting and what makes for a great career. So I have a group of the fellas that I worked with. We're all going to get together and we are going to record some of the Tales from the Road and everybody's favorite jobs that they did, cases they worked on, things we all worked on together. It's really going to be an excellent program, but I'll give you a heads up when that gets closer. So we'll get the neighborhood in here, we'll get the Tales from the Road guys in here, and we'll move along. So let's take a look now at this Iranian situation a little bit. So what we have is we have this military, they call him the military mastermind. All right, if you go to the AmericaOutLoud.com platform, to the website, and you look for the articles by Dennis Santiago, and you look for the article by Alana Friedman, and you read their articles, they give you some great background understanding of this. Now, I've had a lot of people call me, a lot of my friends call, people who have tweeted to me and whatnot, and they're saying, hey, listen, what the heck is Iranian troops and all? What are they doing in Iraq? I mean, how is this this general, Soleimani, what is he doing in Iraq? Because we don't always get a full picture here. You know, we listen to the news. We pay attention to what the news tells us. And we know for the most part the news is going to be slanted. It's going to be biased. We're not going to get really the full story. So if we look real quick, we unpack this quickly. The country of Iran was a almost westernized kind of a country in the Middle East back in the 1970s. The Shah was the leader. We had a close relationship with him. But this is about the time in the 1970s when the modern Islamic revolutionary movement was starting to grow in that part of the world. And one of the reasons I think that was starting to grow is, again, you have to understand the history. If we look at that region, and it's been colonized for years by, you know, the British and the French, and there were lots of different European powers that controlled that entire area. You know, the British controlled what is now Israel, that whole area. The British Empire was everywhere. And it was probably, and I want to say this the proper way, it was easier to control the people in those countries at the time because the Western world had all modern warfare equipment that the Eastern world did not have. So when we rolled in, you could certainly take over. You could control, colonize the location, and run it. And that's exactly what happened for many, many, many years. As time developed, modern world started to develop, and the introduction of the oil into the region started to provide funding for these countries where they could develop their own militaries. You started to see an awareness that they could be more self-determinant. And over the course of time, we saw what happened. There was, battles in many places, and the British Empire, just like it was here 200-something years ago, was defeated, backed down, had to leave. had to cut out, and these countries basically took on a life of their own. Back then, it was easier to overcome them because we had the weaponry. Well, when the battlefield is evened up, these countries could stand up for themselves. They could fight back. And that has really changed the dynamic. And I think as the fundamentalist Islamists started to feel this power, we saw Ayatollah Khomeini, or Khomeini, as they used to call him. He was exiled from Iran. But over the course of time, as his movement grew, it's not really traditional, but it's older-based Islam started to take hold. The Shah was had to be removed, and the Ayatollah Khomeini was ushered in as the leader in the Iranian Revolution. And one of the first things they did was they stormed the American embassy. People, thousands of them, you know, they were taking their land back, and America was there, and they held our people for 444 days. There was 52 people. Now, that number 52 hostages comes into play in our today segment as we move along to it. All right, so the Iranians held our hostages, and President Carter tried negotiating. He tried talking. He tried back channeling. Could not get them released. He even tried sending in a military operation. But unfortunately, what we find over and over again, I always talk about history here. It's important to understand your history, or you can't make modern decisions. Whenever we have a liberal government, a liberal president, a liberal government, one of the first things that they attack is our military. They cut the spending. They don't see the need for it. They don't like a big military. And the military falls into disrepair. We've seen that again and again. So we sent this military team, and it was helicopters went in. They crashed in the desert. We never got to the people, and it was really a debacle. And it cost Jimmy Carter pretty much the election, because even though the media was not pro Ronald Reagan, who was his opponent at the time, it was kind of hard. They did a countdown every night. And if you'll remember, if you're old enough to remember that, day 277, that's how they started the news every night. That in itself is a time capsule, because we didn't have the internet. We didn't have social media. People still watched the big three networks for their news. You know, Jennings and all these guys were big deals. They were the news. So if you wanted to see the news, you watched at 6 o'clock to see world news. Peter Jennings, whatever. And they would start their show with day 342, and it became an embarrassment, and it became, I guess, a symbol of what had happened to our country. We had fallen into a malaise. We had an economic malaise. There were, believe it or not, interest rates on loans and things were in the 20%. You bought a house, and you could have an interest rate of 15, 18%, 20%. Absolutely amazing, and that was all symptomatic of we were losing our prestige. We had a president who didn't know how to fight back. The military wasn't prepared to fight back, and that led to the election of Ronald Reagan. And what people don't see today, we look back and we see Ronald Reagan as this great figure, this great American president. He was also an outsider that came in, and the establishment didn't like him very much either. Even there were, you know, there's never Trumpers today. There were people back then. They weren't never Reaganers, but they certainly weren't on board with this, you know, this former actor. You know, what does he know about anything? And so there are a lot of similarities. And one of the first things he did was build the military back up. Now, his saying, Ronald Reagan's saying, wasn't make America great again, but he had to rescue us from that malaise that the country was in, financially, emotionally. With our patriotism, everything was falling apart. And he didn't say, make America great again. He wanted America to be the shining city on a hill, you know? So the vision was really the same as we see what Donald Trump is doing. So there are lots of parallels. But the rise of Ayatollah Khomeini and his attack on that embassy was the beginning of the modern Islamic revolution in that part of the world. We started to see theocratic governments take over. And we saw them now, they had weaponry to fight back, which changed the paradigm. So in the light of that, the one part of that whole story that's again, another similarity here, Ronald Reagan was elected in November and he was about to take office. And we were doing the countdown still every night, got to day, whatever day it was. And Ronald Reagan basically said that if those hostages are still being held when he's done taking the oath of office, Iran would be a memory, pretty much, is what he was saying. And it was amazing because I remember watching and everybody was wondering what was going to happen because, of course, he's pushing us to the brink of war. We're going to be wiped out by these people. Same thing we're hearing today. And Reagan is taking his oath of office, and at the same time, or very close to, very similarly in time, we heard the news reporting that the Iranian government was taking the 52 American hostages and putting them on an airplane to get them the hell out of Iran and out of Iranian airspace by the time Ronald Reagan was done taking that oath. Now, this goes to a bigger principle that I think we're going to talk about in the next couple segments. I want to put this together. The whole idea of strength. Now, it's almost become a taboo thing to talk about in our country in this nicer, sweeter, more politically correct world. Strength and power is not valued, and the rest of the world is not America. See, the rest of the world still looks at strength as being an important factor. Just like even back in the 1980s when Reagan took over. And he said he was going to go and take care of Iran. You know what that meant? And these people put those hostages on an airplane before he was done taking the oath of office because strength meant something. You know, he was considered someone who would be reckless, who would attack. He would go after you. You know, they called him Ronald Reagan at some points. And we watched that happen. And that was a watershed changing moment for me also. I didn't realize as a young person how my thoughts had really changed. I was influenced by the media and I didn't really understand it, but I saw that and I had to say, well, what else would you do? Why would you not do that? They're holding our people. Why didn't we go get them before? Was my thinking at the time. And I was enlightened by that action and it really changed my whole way of looking at it. So when we see that beginning of that tension between the United States and Iran, it has never ended. Since that time, the Iranians, who made lots and lots of money on their oil, you know, oil is, until recently, we weren't independent. We had to buy oil. So we were beholden to them and many other countries in the region. That gave them power, and they started to use their power. Now, they could never directly attack the United States. They could blow up a bomb, I suppose, or something, but they're not going to win in a conflict with us. Absolutely impossible. So what they turned to was terrorism. They became the sponsors of terrorism, and they are considered now still the greatest state sponsor of terrorism on the planet, the government of Iran, the mullahs who run it. And this General Soleimani was the guy in the background who was responsible for wielding all of that power. He was the mastermind who came up with all the terrorist attacks. He's the one who came up with the plans to subjugate their own people when they rose asking for freedom, demanding freedom. He put them down, killed his own people. So when we see our media today lamenting the fact that President Trump had an opportunity to take out this very, very bad and evil person, this enemy of America whose hands were drenched with American blood, to take him out, and they're lamenting that that shouldn't have happened, that they're siding almost with the Iranian government, we realize we have a very, very serious problem. So historically, this tension between us has been growing. It has never really ended. We've just had a lot of administrations along the way who were not really willing to do maybe what needs to be done once and for all. And that's where we'll come back in a minute here on Chasing Justice.
As we say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
We left off at the end of the first segment there talking about the historical relationship, how we had this build up to the point we are today. And a lot of other administrations certainly would not confront the Iranians in what they were doing. They sponsor terror groups around the world. They sponsor financially a lot of groups that attack Israel on a regular basis. Hezbollah and Hamas and other terrorist groups in the region that are attacking not only Israel, but other countries. They're part of the Syrian mess that's going on now. And we have to understand that, too. Again, how is Iran involved with Syria? How are they involved with this entire area? And I think, again, if you go to the AmericaOutloud.com platform and you read the articles by Dennis Santiago and Ilana Friedman, and there's others. Other people have written also, but these two I'm intimately familiar with because I was on a show with them recently. They'll fill in a lot of the backstory for you to understand. The whole idea is the Iranians, the mullahs who are there now, their idea is that they want to create what's called a caliphate. Now, many of you understand what that is, but some of you don't. I talk to some people. They're very smart people. They don't get that. A caliphate is like a great big giant kingdom. And they want this caliphate, this Islamic caliphate, to go from Iran all the way to the West. They want it to cover Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Israel. And this is where you'll hear the Iranians for years have been saying they want to wipe Israel off the map. You know, the great Satan is the United States and the little Satan is Israel. And their goal is to wipe out Israel. They've been working in the background to attain this power, to build themselves up to a position where they are the ringleader of those countries. They want to lead all of those people, an Islamic revolution, first in that caliphate, and then around the world. Now, one of the things I think sometimes we get stuck in as Americans, we think the whole world thinks like us, and they don't. You know, one of the things I think is missing from our country now is that we have lost our underpinning of religious life. You know, we're removing God from everything, slow and steady. We're removing God from the schools, removing God from the Ten Commandments, from our halls of justice. We're removing God out of everyday life. The attack on Christmas is really what that's all about. And now, the one thing that it's still okay to attack is Christianity. And this is a reality. This is true. This happens on a regular basis. But it's, again, it's symptomatic of what's going on. As America loses our religious underpinning, or as Bill Dallas, the man of faith, likes to say, we're losing our moral compass as we go forward, and we become more and more non-religious, sectarian, as we move forward, we lose the glue that really holds our society together between right and wrong. This is where we see this explosion of violence in our own country. People don't have God to cling to anymore. You know, remember Mr. Obama, you know, we cling to our God and our guns. Well, the whole idea of religion gives you a foundation of right and wrong. It gives you a foundation of responsibility to other people. It gives family, keeps us together. As we lose this, the idea of religion becomes less and less important, and the people that are faithful and religious are portrayed as foolish, believing, you know, in myths. Recently, somebody came out the other day and said, one of these actors, female, I can't remember her name, and it's probably better I don't remember her name. She came out and said, you know, Christianity is a great big giant myth that a lot of foolish people are paying attention to. This is where we're going. So the idea of being driven by a religion is not part of our existence. It's not part of what we do here in America anymore. We used to be very driven by religion. We didn't have a theocratic government, but our government wrote into our founding documents. You know, we have a creator. All religion was built directly into what we were all about, because there was an understanding and a belief that our rights come from God, and it was part of us. It's not anymore. It's my point. I don't want to beat it to death. In the Eastern world, especially in these revolutionary Islamic countries like Iran, they are theocracies. They are run by the religious leaders, are also the government leaders, and they are very driven by their religion. Now, do we have a good enough understanding of Islam as Americans? I don't know that we do. I think we have a twisted picture sometimes of it, only because there's two different ways that it's being it's being portrayed. I know a lot of people who are Muslims. They are very, very nice people. When I talk to them about this terrorism and, you know, you see these attacks by people screaming Allah Akbar and killing people, they're saying, that's not what we are. That's not who we are. Those are people bastardizing our religion. Now, I want to believe that because the people I know are decent people. I couldn't imagine they would do that. But then you see an entire government that rounds up people that don't believe, or in some countries, they go after you because of your lifestyle. You know, if you're gay in some of these countries, they will cut your head off, throw you off a building. This is common practice in these places. Total intolerance to that. You know, women are subjugated to us in the West. This would be intolerable here in our country. But in the East, the thinking is a little different. Now, I'm not saying right or wrong. If that's what they want to do, that's their religion. They have every right to do it. And they can be Muslim here in America. We have freedom of religion, right? But that government over there is run by theocratic people. They are religious in their zeal to do what they believe their religion tells them to do. This is where another confusion for us comes in. Have anybody out there, have you read the Quran? We keep hearing these different stories. If you read the Quran, you'll see where it's bloodthirsty. You'll see where it's telling them to do these horrible things. And then I talk to people that are Islamic, and they say, listen, that's hyperbole. Those are stories. They don't expect us to go and do that now. But we see some of these terrorists, they are literal in their interpretation of what it says in their holy book. And when it says go out and, you know, kill the infidel, they're going out and doing it. So that's kind of hard for us over here in the West to really make sense out of what people we know that are rational and people are irrational. So I recently got a conversation with someone who said to me, well, you know, if you look at the Bible and you read the Old Testament, they stoned people to death. You know, if you were an adulterer, they stoned you to death. If you did all these things, they stoned you to death. And I said, yes, but the Christian religion has had a reformation, if not several reformations. Matter of fact, as it continues to evolve, which it does, you're seeing these splinter Christian groups. They all still believe in Jesus, but they don't believe in the rules of the Universal Catholic Church, or they don't believe in the church, in the Methodist Church recently just voted to split. All right, so there's another split, another evolving as the religion goes. So we haven't stoned anyone to death in thousands of years. But in parts of the Eastern world, the Sharia law, which calls for these violent punishments, the beheadings, they're still doing that. So it's hard for us to understand. You know, I don't think we have enough information to look at it. I think we're biased sometimes against it because it's very scary and it seems very dangerous. And we see actual incidents taking place. So that kind of gives us the perspective, I think, of where we are. So this general, Soleimani, however you pronounce it, this guy he was number two or number three in the Iranian government. You know, the mullahs are the rulers. They're the ones who really in charge, make the decision. This guy, this general, was the power behind the throne. This is the guy when they wanted to suppress their people. You know, the people start rising up in Iran. They want freedom. They want to go back to their westernized life. Not everyone. Some people want to be a fundamentalist, and I guess they can work that out. But there are people that women want to go to school. They want to have normal lives again. They don't want to live under this Sharia law. And they do have a lot of uprisings in Iran. And what we don't hear about it all the time is because they turn off the internet. The government turns off the internet, turns off the reporting. It's not a free society. You're not allowed to go over there and report on whatever you want to report on, so we don't see it. But the people do, and when they rise up, they are often put down very violently to the point of being gunned down, everyone taken from a town, all the young men gunned down, and the architect of that is this Soleimani guy, this general. All right, so his history is one of violence and attack on his own people and on other people. He is responsible for planning the attacks on the embassies in other parts of the world, American embassies. He's responsible for the most recent attack in Iraq on that embassy where President Trump had to send the military in to save everybody there. That is why he was there in Iraq. Iran is more powerful than the fledgling Iraqi government, which is still not got its act together. And they have great influence there because they have great power there. They have the militias. They fund them. They gun them. They get them over there. And that's why this general was in Iraq to begin with. He was fomenting potential attacks against the United States, and our embassy was an example of it. So if you listen to President Trump, you know, he tweets. People hate that he tweets. Other people like it. I look at it as it's a direct pipeline to what he's thinking. Now, when we hear some of the things that he says, because he's really the most accessible president we have had. I can't think of anyone else. He walks out to the helicopter and they ask him a question. He'll stay there for 40 minutes answering questions. He tweets every day. You can tell him, you can tell what's on his mind because he tells you. He says what's on his mind. And it drives the people on the left absolutely crazy because that's not traditional presidential world. Barack Obama started tweeting, started using social media because that is the form of communication of the modern world. Many of us are not used to a president speaking his mind and speaking his mind sometimes in less articulate ways than we would like, in less flowery ways than we're used to. We're used to the president standing with pomp and circumstance. And so, well, you know, if we've been attacked, we will use all options to make sure our people are safe. Where Trump comes out and says, I'll go over and I'll blow you all up and you'll never do it again. All right. Now, that's kind of more how people speak at home. And I can understand why people are a little uncomfortable with it, but it's also refreshing. So if you listen to his tweets after he ordered the attack on this general, which, by the way, was a perfect example of the equipment we now have in the United States. This was a pinpoint attack on one SUV with the Hellfire missiles. Didn't hit buildings, didn't hit other people, didn't hit schools, none of that stuff. Hit one SUV, orchestrated, I'm sure, with satellite technology, drone technology, eyes on the thing. You can imagine how many people were watching this event when that order was given on our side to direct this amazing attack. Long and short of it is, he does that. He orders that attack to rid the world of this terrorist. And in his tweets, what he says was, and I'm going to paraphrase, he says, I didn't kill this general to start a war, as he's been accused. I killed this general to prevent a war. So the information that's, you listen to Mike Pompeo and other people in the government that are coming forward, and they're saying he had information. He's the president. He gets intelligence from these different groups that Soleimani was over in Iraq. They attacked our embassy. He was there for a reason. He was planning a bigger uprising. This is what this guy does. This could have been a moment in time that they decided to take this and make a further attack on the United States. Maybe they would attack Israel. Who knows? But the president, in his tweet, you can read between the lines. He didn't do this to start a war. He did it to prevent a war. And that's the line, to prevent a war. What war would you be preventing? The obvious answer is clear. Whatever he had information about that this Soleimani was planning. And that's why he took him out now. So it seems like it was a good decision. You know, was he justified? It was a preemptive strike. Was it? What is preemption? Preemption is an attack before somebody does something. So I'm going to look for a definition here. The difference between preventive war is that a preventive war is launched to destroy the potential threat of a targeted party when an attack by that party is not imminent. All right, that's preventive. That's a preventive war, preventive attack. A preemptive war is launched in the anticipation of immediate aggression by another party. So preemption, while it does sound like, is that us? In America, do we do preemptive things? I think we do. I think we've done preemption before. I mean, we were in the middle of World War II, and we had developed the atomic bomb, and we used that against Japan before we attacked preemptively to end the war. So I think an argument can be made there that we do things preemptively. We know we have done other drone strikes. We know President Obama did 2,800 drone strikes is the number I read the other day. 2,800 drone strikes in the war on terror. He had information, actionable information about a specific target, and we had the capability, and he took that person out. All right, we didn't hear anybody screaming and hollering then. It's only because Trump did it makes it wrong. So when we look at this idea of preemption, he took this guy out because apparently he is the mastermind, and without him, it's almost like decapitating a snake. While we have the mullahs, they're not the ones planning things. They're not the ones carrying out. They're not the ruthless people in the field ordering the killing. So he's gone now, this Soleimani. He's gone. So this is an opportunity. Now, if you listen to other people, Iranians who are got out of the country, they are overjoyed at this, number one, because this demon is gone from their country. But they're saying this is now the opportunity that people who want to rise up and regain their freedom might be able to do it, because the people that replace this guy are certainly not going to be as well versed as he is. They're certainly not going to be as prepared as he was after 40 years as a leader doing this. Now he's gone. Now you have someone else who has to step up, learn the game, and go out and do it. So the opportunity is there for the people who want to rise up against the mullahs to maybe do it. And I'm sure, as we can all imagine, we have a CIA, we have other organizations in our country that may be reaching out through back doors and trying to maybe help them. Is that the thing to do? Is that involving us in another conflict? The answer is it could be, right? If we get involved in, proxy by arming the people who want to fight up against the mullahs and go after them, you know, we have our hands on it then. Does that draw us in? Does that draw boots on the ground? Not necessarily. It not necessarily does. But is it in our interest? And that's where all of this gets mixed together. What is in our interest? What is justifiable? And what is better for us to stay out of completely? Well, if I know that, the guy up the block is plotting to come and attack my family, and I have really good information that he's about to do this, and I go down the block and punch him in the face and stop him from doing it, I preemptively attack him. Was that justified? He didn't do anything yet. I think it might be justified. But in our world, we're not used to that preemption. We're not used to that America being that preemptive attack. But wouldn't it be smart to go down there and punch the guy in the face so he doesn't come and attack my family? Right? Would I be justified in doing that? I might be. So that's the kind of thing that I think we need to really look at as we go forward, because I think the paradigm is going to shift. In the days and weeks ahead, whatever the Iranians are going to choose to do and their allies to respond to President Trump taking out this terrorist leader, we're going to see it, and it's going to affect all of us. And I think we need to think about that a little bit more. So we'll be back in a minute with round three, and we'll try and wrap this whole mess up for this episode.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Welcome back to round three here at Chasing Justice. Boy, we got it going on today, don't we? I'm trying to wrap all my thoughts up for us here and put this into some kind of perspective, because once we see the historical place we come from with this relationship with Iran, we see what's going on now, then we have to look forward. You know, what could possibly happen down the road? But before we do that, we need to look at the here and now a little closer. One of the most disturbing things, I think, out of this entire situation is that we see a lot of the candidates running for president on the Democrat side all jumping up and down and screaming that this is a war crime. That Trump is, these threats are inappropriate. Matter of fact, Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff have made some announcements along the way that they're considering reopening their impeachment hearings to now include Trump killing this terrorist without their permission. So this is where, do we as Americans, do we all understand the full concepts of, you know, separation of powers. You know, you have the executive branch, you have the judicial branch, which is the Congress, the law guys, and then you have the, the judicial branch is the judges, and then you got the legislative branches, the guys that makes the laws. They are three co-equal branches. Okay, when there's a conflict between any of the branches, that's where the courts step in. They look at it constitutionally, try and make a decision who's right and who's wrong. That's why we see when a subpoena is issued, all right, anybody can issue a subpoena. Any court, any one of the Congress groups, a court can issue a subpoena. If you don't think you should have to respond to that subpoena, either physically and go testify or bring your books, bring your papers, you would go to a court and say, I don't think there's justification for me to respond to this subpoena. The court then looks at it and would make a decision. And sometimes they do cancel a subpoena, what they call quashing. They quash the subpoena and say, nope, it's not a legitimate reason to have someone come in or testify or bring their papers and their effects, whatever. And the subpoena is quashed. It's gone. You don't have to respond to it. So it's understanding that just because the Congress has sent subpoenas to the president, a co-equal branch, the executive of the co-equal branch of government, does not mean he has to immediately do what they say. Just like the president coming up with some kind of a presidential proclamation that the Congress can no longer make laws about taxes. He could do it. He could make a proclamation all he wants. But the Congress doesn't have to abide by a proclamation like that. So this is where we see these people coming out and saying he had no right to start a war without Congress. So let's unpack that a little bit. The Congress is the only body in our government that is permitted to declare a war, right? Congress votes and decides, yes, we are now at war with whoever. The president does not declare war. The president's powers, as the commander-in-chief, he is solely responsible for the protection of the people of the United States and our interests. One of the tools he has to protect the people of the United States is our military. Okay, so just like the police officer has a sidearm when he's out doing his job or her job to protect the public, you have a sidearm, you have a weaponry, right? You have a military, basically, you have training, you got a gun, you got your troops, you call your guys and girls. That's the civilian side. The president, as the commander-in-chief, can certainly use that military, just like the police officer can use his handgun when he believes that I need to do it now to protect somebody or protect myself. All right. The president can order a strike. He can order the sinking of a ship. He can order the limited use of the military. Now, the War Powers Act came into being in the 1970s when we just came out of Vietnam. It was a mess for many years, and we can get into the whole problem for that because we didn't have the political will to win. But the point being, it came up with the War Powers Act that a president can only take unilateral action by himself for up to 60 days. Anything longer than that, he has to go to Congress now. Now, that makes sense. This way you don't have a tyrant at the head of the government deciding to wield American power all over the place for their own good. You have to go to Congress. Now, the Congress represents us. That's where they're a representative form of government, and they represent us. So having that 60-day period gives the executive the opportunity to do what they need to do immediately to protect us. All right? Anything further than that, now you got to go to Congress. They have to listen to it and say, hey, is this something we should be involved in? Do we want to spend the money on this? Is this in our interest? And then they argue it out. And then they make a decision, declare war, not declare war, back down, whatever. That actually is an appropriate way to use government, because it protects each other. But for them to come out and say that because he had this strike on this terrorist, which again, remember, Obama conducted about 2,800 drone strikes on targets that he believed were terrorists and detrimental to the United States. Not one time did anybody jump up and down on either side of the aisle and say, he didn't come to Congress to ask to do that, because he doesn't have to. Right? He doesn't have to do that, nor does he have to immediately respond to a subpoena. So we're going to probably end our program today with a little bit about this impeachment nonsense, but it kind of connects together here. So the president can take unilateral action by himself to protect us. When he gets a subpoena from the Congress, he doesn't have to immediately respond to it. It goes to the courts. That's part of the three branches of co-equal government. We kind of forget that part. When you have somebody like Nancy Pelosi who's running around that we are here to do oversight on the president as though she's in charge of the presidency. And she's not. But that is how the media also portrays it. That, well, the Congress has complete say over what the president does not. So when she says they're going to maybe open the impeachment hearings again because he did this attack on this terrorist without informing Congress, that could certainly roll into a constitutional issue that the courts are going to have to look at because that's not the way it really works. That's not the way the founder set it up. That's not what's in our Constitution. The president can take this action to protect us, and if it goes prolonged, then of course he has to speak to the Congress, but not on day one. He saw a danger, he saw a terrorist, and he acted just like Obama did. Obama assassinated bin Laden. Just because we had an arrest warrant for Obama for killing 3,000 people in the Trade Center and in the Pentagon and in Shanksville doesn't mean we could send our military into a foreign country to go into this man's house and gun him down. But we did it, didn't we? Wasn't it the right thing to do? Didn't we have to serve justice on him? We did, because that was in our interest. Did you see anybody screaming to take Obama to jail, to impeach him? No. So the hypocrisy here runs absolutely wild, and that hypocrisy endangers you and me. Because here we can see, and my point to here is that this impeachment situation is such nonsense. It's not, it's illegitimate, as I have said many times, because the content of the impeachment is false. It's made up accusations. The two counts that they're impeaching him on, one of them is failing to answer subpoenas from the Congress. Well, I just got done telling you. He can go to the court for that. Just because he chooses not to answer them immediately when they want it doesn't mean you get impeached for that. It means it goes to the court, and the court will determine if they're good subpoenas or not. So this entire impeachment thing is a political weapon. They are using this as a weapon. And we all know that. I think everybody out there in Chasing Justice Land knows that by now. Most of the country, I think, is starting to come on board and get that as well. But don't you think that's probably a distraction? Here, the president of the United States got actionable information that he believes he needed to attack this terrorist and take him out. And he did it. And they immediately turn around. They're going to impeach him. Don't you think that that impedes his ability to do his job and protect you and your family? What happens when he gets actionable information that there's a sleeper cell about to attack the town where you live? What should he do? Go wake Nancy Pelosi up? Should he go talk to the squad and get their opinion? Let them tell everybody in the world that we know that it's up? Or should we go get them? Right? See, this is where all of this comes into play. It seems like they're all separate incidents. They're not. This coup d'etat against a elected president, whether you like him or not, is dangerous for all of us. Because it's changing the nature of our government and how it interacts with itself. What they are doing in the Congress is so inappropriate and so against our Constitution and the Founding Fathers' setup of our government that it's taking us to a new place. It's taking us someplace we might not be able to come back from. This terrorist incident where now Iran has said they are going to attack us back. Now, whether they're really going to do it or not, we're going to find out in the coming days. But the fact that they said they're going to attack us back, and we have members of our government who are standing up taking sides with them, with the terrorist, just so that they can attack the president and say he's taking a war action without Congress, he's being unconstitutional, when that's not the case at all. And the media, does the media point out anything I've just pointed out to you? Have they sat and explained, well, listen, hang on a second, Mrs. Pelosi. You're saying that he's starting a war. Where's the declaration of war? Did the president declare war on Iran, or did he attack a terrorist? Because, you know, he's allowed to do that and then hold up the papers, the War Powers Act, and point to them. Nobody's done that. They just shake their heads and go, something more to impeach the president about, and they roll right along. This is why they're considered fake news. This is why it's dangerous. The press has a very important part in our lives and our freedom. The press was seen as a necessary organizational setup to call out when people were using power inappropriately, to write stories about things, to bring the truth out. It's not Pravda from the Soviet Union where it's only the government side. This was supposed to be, no matter who's in power, the press. Somebody says it's nighttime, they should check the clock. And if it's not nighttime, they should raise their hand and say, hey, Mr. President, it's not nighttime. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Why would you say it's nighttime? You're supposed to hold them, to hold their feet to the fire. So that we have that, that you and I, the American people, have somebody in our corner speaking for us when we can't. That is a vital, important part of a democratic lifestyle that we have. And our press going all one direction, not telling you the truth, lying to you, and then not correcting it. Let's just say they all believe this nonsense about the, you know, the Russian collusion. Say they all believed it. They had sources that taught, and they believe. Well, now, once the Mueller report came out and all these other people come out and we see how the FBI was abused to go after Trump, once they see the truth, don't you think they should say, hey, we were taken for a ride. Here's what really happened. How come they haven't done that? How come the only places you're hearing this is very, very few media outlets and here on America Out Loud? Right? All the different hosts here that are talking about it. We're trying to get it out there. We're writing about it. Why is the press not doing their job? That's a danger to us. Do you see the implosion of our system is happening right in front of our eyes? This most recent situation with Iran is pulling the cover off it, just like the impeachment is. It's pulling the cover off. We had people standing up. There's a young woman, and again, I don't remember her name. She's on social media, and she's an influencer, you know? And for those of us who didn't grow up with social media but are dealing with it now, you know, social media is a main form of communication. Do you think the next president is not going to tweet? Do you think the next president's not going to go on Facebook? Of course they are. This is with us forever now. This is an evolution of communication. So this young woman has this, she has a million followers or something, and she comes out, and she's standing there with her arms crossed, looking all defiant, and she says, killing the terrorist in Iran was the right thing to do, but because Trump did it, it was wrong. Now, when I saw that, I didn't know if it was a joke or not, because wouldn't that be the most confounding thing you've ever heard? It's the right thing to do, but because he did it, it's not right. Is that what we've come to? Is that the maturity? We are potentially going to be in a conflict where people are going to die, and we're saying, well, because he did it, it's not right, and that serves as discourse on something so important. We have this nonsense impeachment rolling on and on and on. In the meantime, we got a president who may have to send troops to their death, may have to attack another country. Citizens in those countries might die, and we can't even talk about this because we have this nonsense impeachment. This is the danger of all of this. And this is where each and every one of us has to look at this. And instead of holding your biases, ask yourselves the question, is what I'm being told right, or am I just being influenced because I hate this guy so much? I hate his hair. I hate the way he talks. I hate the way he tweets. I hate the way he says things. If that's how you're making decisions, you are the problem. Do you understand? I didn't like Obama, not because Obama as a man. I didn't like his policies. I didn't like what he stood for. But he was still my president. I didn't like any of the things he did to our country. But he was our president, and when he had to go and use military force somewhere, I backed up my president. I said, yeah, well, he's the president. He probably has information I don't. They're not doing that anymore. They're turning on him. They're siding with Iran. I saw one piece today. This female reporter came out, was lamenting the loss of the great general to the Iranian people, how they love him. He was such a beloved figure in their country, except when he marched into town and gunned down all the men in their village because they decided to ask for freedom. You know, other than that, he was really a great guy, and that evil Trump, you know, killed him, you know, committed a war crime. So I'm getting a little annoyed here, as you can tell, as I go. So I'm going to calm down for a minute. I'm going to calm down here. All right. The last comment I'm going to have on that is probably the war crimes commentary that we've seen now several of the Democratic candidates come up with. This is a war crime, what he did. It's a war crime. AOC, you know, AOC, as Mark Levin, the great one, Mark Levin, has coined her. She came out and said, by targeting cultural sites, he's going to kill women and children, and that's impeachable, and that's in this and that. Do you really think Donald Trump is going to send Hellfire missiles into a hospital filled with little children? Do you really think that? Do you think he's going to do that? Or is it possible that when he says things that are of great cultural importance to them, he doesn't mean apartment buildings and hospitals? Maybe he means something that means something to them, and he'll take it out. Maybe it's a statue. Maybe it's a facility with ornaments in it or something. Now, of course, you really shouldn't ruin historical pieces. I'm not advocating for that. But my point is to immediately say that when he says cultural, that means he's going to kill people. He's going to kill people in a concert. The heated rhetoric, this immediate jump to the other side, no matter what he does, it's wrong. And he has no support. The rest of the world sees that. These terrorists see that. They are emboldened by this kind of thing, right? That is dangerous to our country. So the rest of us have to stand up and say, no, that's not right. We have to hold their feet to the fire and demand of our representatives. Call them, right? Tell them this is not right. Do the right thing. All right, so I'm going to end on another note, because now I'm getting all annoyed with this situation. I'm concerned, and I wish I had some way to do something more than just talk on the radio. But I have to say that the impeachment thing that's coming out, I saw Lindsey Graham came out and said a great thing the other day, and I've grown to see him in a much better light than I did previously. Lindsey came out the other day and he says, listen, Ms. Pelosi doesn't want to turn over the articles of impeachment. Which is really impeding the Senate now, isn't it? Because they're supposed to do the articles of impeachment and turn them over. He says, if she doesn't do it in about a week, we can certainly change the rules of the Senate. McConnell and I can change the rules of the Senate that we can have the trial without the articles of impeachment, and we can do an acquittal, or we can dismiss the entire thing outright, and then she has pieces of paper in her hand that are worthless. Is that something they should do? I think it's nonsense. I think the more we move towards a trial, the more we justify what they did. I think at first I thought maybe it'd be a good idea to, you know, bring up a bunch of people to show how ridiculous it is, but I think you give it credibility. There is no credibility. It should be declared an absolutely fraud, an absolutely fictitious thing that they've done, and dismiss it outright. My friends, this brings us to the end. This goes so fast, our time together. I'll see you every day at 3 p.m. here on Chasing Justice. And remember, listen for me on Viewpoint Sunday, 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Until then, remember, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. God bless America.